Penguin Random House Canada presents an abridged audio production of An Evening with W. O. Mitchell, a collection of the author's best-loved performance pieces. Selected and featuring introductions by Ormond Mitchell.
Preface. An Evening with W. O. Mitchell, a collection of the author's best-loved performance pieces, was published in 1997 by McClelland and Stewart. Selected and edited by my wife Barbara and me, it was the last book my father published. He died a year later. In the preface, my father wrote the following. The art experience is not private. It is a bridging, or at least the illusion of bridging, between two creative partners, the artist and his reader. If the artist has found fragments out of his past life, and then built an illusion in which every single bit is the truth, and the whole thing is a more dramatic, more meaningful lie, there will be triggered off for his partner explosions of recognition, which the reader mistakenly attributes solely to the artist. Actually, the recognition belongs to both of them, and the reader's contribution comes out of his own subconscious notebook during the art experience. It is quite possibly the most intimate relationship between two humans, bar none. And yet, writing is an intensely private and lonely act. Writing is like playing a dart game with the lights out so that the writer has no way of knowing whether his darts are coming anywhere near the bullseye or are missing the board entirely. For the writer, the lights come on long after his darts have been thrown. Even though his readers and reviewers may indicate that he has scored, the next time the writer plays the game, he will again be alone and in the dark. Early on, I was lucky enough to find two creative partners who helped dilute that lonely darkness for me, who acted as caring, honest, and perceptive sounding boards for draft after draft of my stories. Professor F.M. Salter, for the 6 years I spent writing Who Is Seeing the Wind, and my wife Myrna, for almost everything I have ever written. Almost everything. For on occasion, she refused to be verbally flogged by yet another draft of a scene. Then, later on in my career, I discovered another way to help dilute the writer's darkness. Reading performances. My one-man shows over the years have given me what all stage performers love. The immediate thrust of a live audience as it responds to story magic. Here, on stage, was no illusion of bridging between storyteller and audience. And I know immediately when the darts hit the center, when we are really flying together. The dedication to An Evening with W. O. Mitchell illustrates my father's belief in the communal and genetic elements of storytelling. He wrote, "Thanks to my creative partners, Barbara Mitchell and Ormond Skinner Mitchell, also to my father, O. S., who died when I was 7, and who was a turn-of-the-century stand-up comedian. I owe them all." Barbara and I persuaded McClelland and Stewart to do an audio book of my father's in-performance recordings of 5 of the 31 pieces in An Evening with W. O. Mitchell. This new expanded Penguin Random House audiobook includes 4 additional in-performance recordings. The Day I Sold Lingerie in a Prairie Whorehouse, Brian Skates, Healy Richards, and King Motherwell. My father loved to tell stories. Rudy Weeb once observed that if storytelling is a sign of evolutionary progression, then Bill Mitchell was the most advanced of the human species. When my father told a story, it was a visual as well as an oral performance. His shock of white hair, gravelly voice, and dramatic gestures became trademarks of his one-man shows, as did his snuffbox. In 1968, when he was struggling to give up the nicotine habit, Burl Ives suggested he try snuff. He did, and was hooked on Joseph and Henry Wilson's finest menthol snuff for the next 30 years. This indulgence, he rationalized, gave him the nicotine high, but not the cancer risk. He said it would have to do until someone invented a nicotine suppository. His readings were punctuated with sniffs as he took a pinch of snuff from one of his antique snuff boxes, often at a moment when his audience was eagerly waiting for his next line. His reading glasses also became a stage prop. They were often held together at the bridge with white adhesive tape. During one of his readings at the Banff Center, he was using a pair of glasses with only one arm, and they clattered onto the lectern. He explained, "I left my glasses in Prince Edward Island. This is my spare, and one arm is gone. I get them at Woolworth's. I get six at a time because I drop glasses all over North America." In The Day I Spoke for Mr. Lincoln, when describing Miss Finch's elocution lessons, he gave a seemingly impromptu performance of The Fool. He paused to look up at his audience over his glasses and, holding up his original copy of The Fool, given him in 1930, said, "Well, look, here's The Fool, and here's Billy Mitchell performing it." He then stepped aside from the podium and microphone and punched out The Fool in classic elocutionary style, using the various facial and hand gestures he had been taught by Miss Finch. The Day I Spoke for Mr. Lincoln. In The Day I Spoke for Mr. Lincoln, my father describes his first major public performance as an elocutionist on May the 30th, 1930. He was 16 years old. This is one of seven pieces, based on childhood and adolescent memories, and written in the early 1960s, which launched my father's career as a performer and became the backbone of his reading repertoire over the next 35 years. These pieces are not fiction, but also not exactly fact. Some of them, such as Melvin Arbuckle's first course in shock therapy, are reminiscential tall tales. Others, such as Take One Giant Step, are closer to the kind of nostalgic childhood memory pieces perfected by Dylan Thomas in A Child's Christmas in Wales and A Visit to Grandpa's. The Day I Spoke for Mr. Lincoln, however, is based largely on accurate recall of Mrs. Wilkinson's school, his elocution teacher, her actual name was Miss Ney, and his reciting Lincoln's Gettysburg Address on May 30th, 1930. Here, then, is my father performing The Day I Spoke for Mr. Lincoln in the Stratford Festival Hall on July the 3rd, 1983.
Whenever what was called Dominion Day rolls around, and even day before yesterday, I felt a faint twinge of old guilt, because once I committed an act of treason, and I'm reminded of it every year. That was the year I studied to become what was known as an elocutionist. Every Saturday morning, it was the third year, I think, that we lived in St. Petersburg, Florida. But my mother, without benefit of Mendelian law, decided that musical and recitative talents were sex-linked characteristics. Now, my grandpa, on my father's side, had been tone deaf. My father couldn't tell the difference between God Saves the King and Pop Goes the Weasel, and my mother, who sang in alto in Knox Presbyterian Choir in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, knew where I stood. Now, she believed bad things came in threes. She also believed positively good things came in threes.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?